Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on the show, we will talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I speak with Megan Elliott, a structural engineer, preservation expert, and serial entrepreneur. She founded Revitalize Minnesota and New History, a consulting firm dedicated to developing actionable solutions to the most challenging sites and historic buildings. Megan also launched Jill Pine, a real estate development company that dives into the complex but rewarding world of revitalizing high potential historic sites. Megan specializes in all aspects of historic preservation, which helps her clients navigate the multifaceted opportunities and challenges of historic properties. Her businesses are like an oxpecker, a small African bird that picks pests off the backs of large African mammals. Her clients have a wide variety of these bugs that could derail their efforts to revitalize historic properties. Megan can help with structural logistics, securing financing, government programs, and historic regulations. In this episode, we discuss how she builds business after business around solving more problems for the same clients, all to serve a greater mission of preserving a community's history for future generations. Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kangas, and today I am meeting with Megan Elliott, who practices historic preservation with her background in structural engineering and so many other things that help her serve her clients and do amazing things. Lots of incredible projects that she's been working on here in Minneapolis and around the state. Thank you for joining me, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about this? Because you're the structural engineer that I get to talk to. We don't often get to have, I don't know, you've just been very integrated into the historic preservation world and worked with a lot of architects I know. Tell us a little bit about how you got where you are.
Sure. I'll tell you a little bit of the, I'm going to call it like the origin story behind why I do what I do and how that path of maybe starting as a structural engineer turned into something else. So one thing that a lot of people know about me, some people don't, but I'll say defining moment in my career, I was in the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, and I was living in Santa Cruz at the time, and I'll just date myself a little bit, but I was in high school in 1989, and that earthquake, if you're familiar with that earthquake, it also gets called the World Series earthquake because the upper deck fell on the lower deck of the Bay Bridge during the World Series that year between the Oakland A's and the San Francisco Giants. That earthquake everyone talks about and thinks about San Francisco and what happened there, but where it was actually epicentered was my hometown at the time, and I was living in Santa Cruz at the time with my family, and that town was devastated, and the entirety of the town was, also the commercial area of town was generally destroyed, and the aftermath of that was, to me, as a high school student who was, we were cut off from gas and water and electricity, and my dad was caught over the hill. He couldn't get back home, and we lived out of the car for a few days because we couldn't go inside the house. And I remember walking around town, and virtually every commercial building was gone downtown. And the town did a remarkable job of building a tent city to recover. But as in that period of time between the earthquake and when they got back on their feet, there was just this almost zombie-like feeling of being lost. And of course, there was the feeling of just general loss, some people having lost homes and lost family members and lifestyles and possessions, of course. But there was also this sense of just, I'll say, placelessness, of not having the world around you that you once understood. And there was this moment for me of realizing that how much we rely on the world around us, like the physical world around us, whether it's by eyesight or what we see or what we hear, but how we physically navigate the world, so much of it depends on the physical space around us. And from that point, it became like my mission in life to understand why we build what we build, and then to retain what we build so that we can understand who we are, where we came from, and then make better decisions about going forward. So that was really the point in my life that I started to think about, I'll say, the construction industry generally as a career and understanding the built world generally as a career. And I studied engineering and actually visual arts as an undergraduate. And then I studied engineering and architecture in graduate school. And I came out into, I'll say, the world of general practice. And I between architecture and engineering. Engineering was a little bit of a better fit for me in terms of, I have a very analytical approach to the world. And so I spent a lot of time, I got my license as a structural engineer in California. And I spent the first part of my career, about the first 10 years, practicing as a structural engineer in a very niche specialty field of earthquake engineering. And earthquake engineering means keeping buildings life safe through seismic events and focusing on life safety of historic buildings. But as I was there, I was looking around and feeling like engineering is a really, really important part of keeping buildings and keeping historic buildings specifically in use and viable. But it is like one piece of this really big puzzle. And it also felt like engineering, and I'll say design in general, was generally undervalued in terms of what it could provide to sort of a building reuse solution or a building reuse equation. So from there, I started to think about how do I elevate design and the solutions design can bring to an overall building project, which, to be stereotypical about it, to be a little gross about it, to be frank about it, often gets driven by, I'm going to say, real estate and real estate driven decisions, bottom line decisions, what your lender needs, what your lender requires. But there is a lot of value that I think sometimes we're not uncovering through understanding the design requirements or even the physical requirements of reusing the building. So I landed in Minnesota through a spouse and a job that he took at the University of Minnesota. I don't have any connections in Minnesota. I got to Minnesota and they told me they don't believe in earthquakes. So here I am in the only state in the country, I think, that has completely deleted the word seismic from all building codes. And I've spent the last 10 years generating as much value as I can in earthquake engineering and how to keep buildings life safe through earthquake events. And now all of a sudden I have no value in the engineering world. So I decided, what better time to start a company?
Absolutely.
I was able to find a very sympathetic and supportive engineering firm called MBJ, and you might be familiar with them. And when I went to work with them, I basically said, like, I'm a good engineer. I want to practice engineering, but I'm going to work for you. And while I'm here, I'm going to be starting this other company. And I probably talked to 10 engineering firms and I got 9 out of 10 no's. Because who would let someone walk into a company, take an engineering job and say, hey, I'm going to sit in this corner and start a company under your roof? But I did find MBJ. They were extremely supportive. And I concurrently worked for MBJ as a structural engineer, transferred my license to Minnesota, met people in the industry, networked, understood this new thing I'd never been exposed to before called snow and ice in terms of how we design around that. And then in the meantime, I started New History, which was intended to be and still is a consulting company for just all of the myriad problems that come with historic building development and historic building reuse, which are absolutely design driven, but so many other things impact it, from policy decisions to funding sources to, I'm going to say, neighborhood and social context issues to market demands to what elected officials want to see. I mean, these buildings are really sticky lightning rods that gather a lot of problems and red tape around them. So setting up a solution with a consulting company that could help our clients, I'm going to say, comprehensively navigate the problems around historic building redevelopment was the reason I started New History. And then, as I mentioned to you earlier, I have since then started another company called Jill Pine, where I can do the real estate development myself, which I joke with people is the platform I use when I can't convince any clients to take on the project. I just say, like, forget it, I'm going to do it myself and take on the real estate development myself. So that is my journey as a structural engineer. And I think it's still, like, at my core, I still deploy my engineering kind of knowledge and services, and problem solving is always in the background of everything that I do. But I have tried and continue to try to kind of elevate that skill set to a kind of a larger problem solving platform for historic buildings specifically.
I think it's amazing how you've leveraged your interest in the analytical and you've really dove in where there's problems. It is not the easy path. You keep finding the harder and harder path and you're like, I'm going there. I'm going to fix that. And I just love how you're filling in these gaps along the way. It's an incredible journey. It's an incredible story. And I just can't wait to see how it continues to improve the historic preservation in the communities all around Minnesota that you're serving. I think that really dives into that question of how you've designed your firm to reflect your personal strengths and your hopes and your dreams. Do you have a vision for where you want this to go? Like, do you have that crazy, like, in 10 years, this is going to be just What is that vision for you that you see at the end of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's one, I will be honest, that I grapple with. As you might have guessed from the story I just told you, I am a serial entrepreneur, and I do use, I'll say, business specifically and entrepreneurship specifically to solve problems. And I feel like I have started New History. I have created a platform. You may or may not know, we recently added an office in Milwaukee, and we are super excited that we have what used to be known as Preserve Design Studio, led by Donna Weiss, is now leading our Milwaukee office. Another woman-owned small business. And now she is, we jokingly say, New History East, and we are New History West here in Minneapolis. But I feel like I've created a platform to solve problems. And then since then, of course, I don't want to say I've moved on, but I need to keep kind of filling that space that I love, which is kind of entrepreneurship and starting businesses and solving problems. And my challenge right now is I want to make New History sort of the business that Donna, and you might have met Kirk Davis, who's also one of our principals at New History. I'm trying to make it the platform that they can continue to run. And of course, I'm very engaged in it. I still own the company. I still engage with the team on a daily basis. But I'm trying to grow it to be a company that everyone can participate in, both on, I'll say, the problem-solving level and the leadership level across the team, while I recognize that my own interests, perhaps even my own talents, might be better served by Jill Pine at this point in my life. And so my struggle right now is, you know, making sure that company at New History has what it needs, both from my leadership as well as my experience, as I have, I'll say, new leaders kind of growing into that space to continue to carry that company forward. I think one of the challenges as a founder of that company is I have built, as you might have said earlier, Katie, so much of myself into that company that it is hard to have other people kind of take that on. And I've tried to give them the flexibility to take the company where they need to take the company. But there is a lot of me that is still like very much stuck to that company. And it is a business challenge to separate myself from New History and for our clients to separate me from New History so that next team of leaders can grow and continue to lead it.
That is a big struggle. Most architects wait to do it at the end of their career, and it takes 10 plus years. So the fact that you're doing it now reminds me of a book I just read called Founder, Farmer, Tinker, Thief. And it is going through that entrepreneur journey of how you start as the founder where everything is you, and then you're the farmer where you're planting these seeds, and then you tinker with it. And then at the end of that journey, you're the thief where you're picking and stealing, like Robin Hood, stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. You're like this mastermind behind the scenes, but you've passed it along. And it's just cool to hear you going through that journey. Right now, I'm kind of like founder farmer stage with my business, just 5 years in. And so it's hard to even imagine letting go of the reins that way. But it's very exciting to hear how you're starting to break into that so that you can make space for other good in your life and in your career that you can apply yourself to. That's really cool. Well, this is kind of a challenging question because you've got two companies to describe, so I'll let you pick. What three words describe your firm's unique approach? Do you want to talk about New History or Jill Pine?
Well, I'll start with New History, and then I think there's a lot of relationships between the two of them.
Okay.
You asked me for three words, but I'm going to give you three concepts because I think it provides a little more insight and clarity. You're a design professional. You know that we're service providers. We're in a service industry. And I think a lot of times service providers are selling the service as, I'm going to say, the product or the end. I think one very distinct part of New History is that we're not selling a service, we're selling a solution. And the reason people come to us is because they have a challenge with a historic building. They don't know how to solve it. And oftentimes, we don't know what service we're going to need to solve it, but we know we can figure out what service that is. And it might be something we do in-house. It might be something that we get out of house or have to bring someone onto our team. But at the end of the day, we're trying to have the biggest toolbox we possibly can. And sometimes that toolbox isn't even our tools, but know that we're selling a solution to our clients who are in a lot of pain around a historic building and not just the services themselves. So I think an outcome versus a process maybe is one way to think of it. So that's one, I'll say one distinctive concept. The second distinctive concept is we're a for-profit company, but we are absolutely mission-driven. So everything that we do is to increase the use and viability of historic and existing sites and buildings. period. And everyone knows that about us. No one comes to us for a new building, but we are, everything we do is in the context of this mission. And does this drive our mission forward to increase the use of historic buildings? So mission driven would be the second concept. And the third concept I thought of was, and this is maybe could be condensed into one word, is interdisciplinary. And that I think we have recognized, or at least I've recognized, that it really takes so many skills to solve these problems. And you know, I came from an engineering and architecture background. I love engineering and architecture, but I also recognize that it is a really important seat at a table, and there's many other seats at the table. So within our office, yes, we have design professionals, but we also have historians and people with city planning background and public history and real estate finance, you know, and a lot of people bring like multiple skills and backgrounds with them, because we're all there to get to that solution versus just sell that one skill that we've built. So those are my three concepts of outcomes-based, having a clear mission, and being truly interdisciplinary.
I love it. And I'll take it all, because sometimes three words isn't enough. And so it is very clarifying to hear how you're balancing that process and serving your clients. So who are your clients? How do you define the people that you're looking for and the people you're trying to serve?
We struggled a lot with how to define that a couple of years ago. And I think we finally settled on this concept of our clients being, at New History, I should say, our clients are visionary stewards of historic buildings and sites. And they may not even own the building yet, but they understand that they're going to walk into this position and they're going to be stewarding this building either through a project or even for the next generation. Or they're an owner that is, you know, committed to stewarding this asset. So we're looking for visionary stewards, whether they're public clients or private clients or real estate developers, even architects. I mean, a lot of our clients are architects, or our referral base are architects. These architects being in the role of working with an owner to come up with a design solution or a long-term, I'm going to say, capital improvement plan or some sort of change to the building. But everyone is stewarding this building to kind of its next chapter of life or continuing its current use. So we think of our clients as being visionary stewards of these assets. And then that they're those, the vision that they have is recognizing this asset has additional value, maybe beyond what it has today, and can be, and the value can increase through whatever services we're providing.
That's wonderful. And it's great when people see the inherent value in their buildings. There's a lot of gray area there where people are on that journey where they maybe have a building and they're not ready to maybe make that commitment. Maybe they're on their way to becoming the steward of the space. Maybe they're on their way to seeing the vision for the space. So I understand that that's also a growth journey for the clients. Do you capture people earlier on in their process towards becoming these advocates for historic buildings and help them through if that's where their project needs to go?
In the, I'm going to say, in the arc or trajectory of a project, if I think about it from, I'm going to say like a typical architectural words of maybe feasibility and due diligence and pre-design into schematic design, design development, construction documents, construction, et cetera, we tend to skew very much forward. And I think we provide most of the value on the front end of a project when an owner is, or when a client, developer, owner, et cetera, is considering even like whether they're going to do a project. Or if they're going to do a project, how big is it? And how are they going to pay for this project? So all of these kind of really big fundamental questions we're answering at the front end with our clients. And the reality is not all of our projects that we work on at the front end ever become design and construction projects. A lot of times we're helping people find the right outcome of the building, which may not include their involvement, right? It may be that the best solution for the building is for it to be transferred to a different owner or some sort of sale process to happen throughout the project. So we are providing, I'd say, the highest value of services, typically at the beginning of the project. That being said, we stick with our clients through the entirety of the projects, and we're oftentimes working in conjunction with the project architect, design team of record, helping our clients put together the right team, for example, and then through construction and closeout. So we're there through the entirety, but we tend to skew forward. With our new Milwaukee office, I'll say that office is a little stronger than we are in the maybe the construction process and construction oversight through and working with contractors. So we're thinking about how we maybe rebalance our services to be more consistent throughout the project as compared to really front-end loaded. So we're still navigating what that might look like because our Milwaukee office is only 3 weeks old. So we're still figuring out how that's going to play out.
Oh, yes. Just an infant. I love it. Exciting new change. So yeah, being at that front end of the project is such an important place. And it's often where there's all these questions. And I appreciate how you're like, got to be kind of generalist with it, because it may come from tax credits, it may come from alternative funding sources, it may come from. And so it's knowing all those tools. How do you not overwhelm your client when your client, maybe they know they need help, they think they've got a building, they're like, maybe they make assumptions right away that like, there's no way I can afford to remodel this or to rehabilitate or to preserve this in place. So what are some of those ways that you talk with them? What are some experiences you've had at that front part of the project that helps really align your services with what your client and finding that fit with the clients?
I think one of the most important lessons I learned kind of early on in business is not all clients communicate or listen the same way. And I can potentially say like literally the exact same words to two different clients and they will hear two very different things. And I think one of the biggest learning curves for any entrepreneur in starting, I'm going to say a service-oriented business is, and I share this with my team all the time, but understanding how you have to communicate so that your client hears what you're saying. And some clients want a lot of information and then they need to like take it all in and they'll come back to you in a day or a week or a month with after they've kind of heard you and vetted and talked to their accountants and talked to their attorney, and they're going to go do all their research on their side and come back with where they want to go. Other clients, they only want like the top three bullet points and they want you to tell them what to do. And they might just want it in an email or a phone call. And so figuring out both the format and the type of words you're using, how fast you're delivering them, all of that is part of, I think, creating that, I'm going to say, communication and trust with a client. And it takes some time. I'll say it's taken me years to learn that skill set of how to speak so my clients hear what I'm saying. But I think that's a lot of that comes into that early part of a project, and why we have, I'm going to say a lot of strength at the early part of a project is because a lot of what we're doing at the very beginning is figuring out how our clients are going to hear us best. And then creating our, I'm going to say, communication style and cadence to match what they can hear and intake. And obviously, you know, public clients are subject to a very different type of oversight and listening and documentation than, say, our private clients or real estate developers who want services delivered in a very different style. And frankly, usually in a confidential style. So it's been a lot of, I think our number one tool for having that conversation, like you mentioned, is learning how to talk so our clients hear what we're saying.
And so what are some ways that you are asking questions or having those first conversations?
I mean, it is
to even suss out which path that you think, because your first value is outcomes-based, and that makes so much sense with speaking the language that your clients value and talking with them about what they value. But for us as professionals, we know that there's very different paths and very different services asked. And so how are you figuring out what plan to put in place when you first reach out?
I think some of it comes down to trying to figure out what's the real thing they're asking for. So I'd say over half of the, I'm going to say the initial calls we get from a new client. I'm going to say a new client because a lot of our existing clients know who we are and they know how to pick up the phone and kind of rattle through what they're thinking, and we know how to respond to them. But with new clients, we often get the call of something like, I want historic tax credits, send me a proposal for historic tax credits. And that may be what they need, but maybe the real question they're asking is this a good building for me to redevelop as housing? Or is this a building I should acquire? Or there's so many, or maybe they're just asking, is this building listed in the National Register as a first step? Like there's so many things that they could be asking, even though they've heard that we can access historic tax credits. And so they're calling us and that's what they're going to ask for. And so I think trying to figure out early on what their real question is part of how we get to figuring out what service they need, which may or may not be what they originally called and asked for. So we are okay in, with having a client call us for historic tax credits and then us working with that client for a week or two or maybe a month or two and realizing that maybe historic tax credits is not a good fit because they need to change that building so dramatically to make it work as anything that historic tax credits, they're just going to be spending too much time on bureaucracy and design for a solution that's just never going to meet the historic tax credit standards. So our best service to that client might be to tell them, like, don't pursue historic tax credits. Think about this other resource or this other way of financing your project. And that's maybe the real question you're asking me is, how do I make this redevelopment work versus, you know, fill out a tax credit application for me? So I think a lot of the starting point is trying to understand what's the real problem they're trying to solve. And sometimes it is just as simple as, oh, you need historic tax credits? You've got your design, you've got your architect, you've got your bank lined up. Absolutely. Let's just get on board with doing the historic tax credit application. But oftentimes it's listening and trying to understand what the real problem is to get started.
And now it starts to make so much sense that you have such a broad team with you because you need to be able to pull from your bench these different experts if different scenarios arise with projects.
Yes, that is exactly why we have a deep bench.
I love it. So can you describe how Jill Pine kind of started to fit in and fill in? Maybe that's deepening your bench in a different direction too.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to have, I'm going to say, these two sister companies that both absolutely inform one another. I keep them, from a business perspective, I keep them separate because the liabilities, the risks, the operating models of a consulting company, and even the cash flow, I'll say, just be frank about it, is so dramatically different than the risks, liabilities, how you get paid as a developer. That those two things, I know there's people out there that combine them. I think as a business owner, I like keeping them separate and I like having a way of having my consulting team, I'm going to say, shielded from the risks of real estate development, which are extremely real. So I keep those two companies separate. And then as a real estate developer, I am able to bring the skills that I've learned. I mean, I don't want to say like the hard lessons I've learned in real estate development back to my team and back to my clients in New History who are trying to navigate the same problems I've had to navigate as a developer. So there is definitely a much deeper understanding that I've been able to gain from doing the development myself to bring back to our clients and to my team. And then likewise, as a developer, Jill Pine is very intentionally just me. I don't have any employees. I don't intend to ever have any employees. So then I can use the consulting team at New History to augment like my capacity as a developer. So I can hire, as a developer at Jill Pine, I can hire New History to provide consulting services and help me move those projects forward. So there's definitely a good kind of symbiotic relationship and overlap between those two companies. And then, you know, in terms of like why I started Jill Pine, it really came out of my, I'm going to say, insatiable problem-solving desire and seeing certain clients and certain projects where I felt like there is a solution there. It's just that no one else wants to put in like the time or the hard work or can actually like see realistically how to get it across the finish line. And because I love to solve problems, I get myself sucked into really hard projects. And the first project I did was actually for a New History client who I could see there was a way to get the project done, but I could also see that he had like real project fatigue. And you know how that is. Sometimes you just like, you can't see the solution anymore because you're just like so tired of banging your head against the wall. And as a developer, like you run out of money and like it gets really tough to carry a building that's not performing. So that first project really came out of seeing a client, seeing a potential solution, but then recognizing that client was just out of capacity to move it forward. And so that was when I stepped in as a partner at that point and completed the project as a partner and then continued to work with that client, frankly, as a co-owner of the building.
That's incredible. And it's so true because so many clients come to us and they have unrealistic expectations of timelines. And so especially once historic and state reviews and all of these other onuses come in and they're the reason you want professionals on your team, they're the reason you want New History solving those problems for you. but just the expectation for how long it takes and that fatigue, that is so, that makes so much sense. It seems so real.
Yeah. These projects are hard, as you've noted. I mean, 10 years, it's not unreasonable for a project to be in progress for 10 years, right? To get to a viable solution.
And I think your background in California probably prepared you for that, because that's how I hear a lot of California projects take their time going through that review process before it's comfort with delayed satisfaction. You've got to be comfortable with and trust the process in the meantime and know that eventually you are going to get there. And it's amazing that you can see that path and be that energy to hold people to that and carry them forward. I love hearing that.
I try to remind people that hitting singles is just as important as home runs, because we're usually just having to like hit the next single and just keep it moving incrementally forward, because it's typically impossible or infeasible to hit a home run, right? It is just not possible for these projects to hit a home run, come up with a plan and have it done in a year. It's really about just consistently hitting singles.
I love that. And you've touched on a few words that kind of relate to your bird that I would like to share with you. I had a hunch that you were this bird, and through this conversation, it's just secured in my mind. There is a bird called an oxpecker. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's in Africa. They eat the little ticks and annoyances off of big animals. So they live off the back of giraffes, buffalo, rhinos, zebras, and they are there to solve problems. They cure the disease. They take away the annoyance of the flies around the head. But the idea of being this consultant, being this helper to these large projects and these large clients, you're there picking away the bugs and all the problems that arise, and you're just there. And it's just incredible to me to hear how many of those annoyances that you tackle, because I think that's the success of being a good oxpecker type business, being that strong consultant, is that you understand your clients so well that you're starting to preemptively pick up those problems before they even feel them buzzing around. And so I think it's great for the health of a project. It elevates you because you are part of their process and improving how this project moves forward. And so that's what I've got for you as a little memory piece.
Well, I've never heard of an oxpecker, but I can absolutely see how you made the connection. And I will just make the oxpecker my new spirit animal.
There we go. They're pretty incredible and persistent and tenacious, which also describes a lot of what is required for the work that you take on. And I really appreciate you opening up about a lot of that. Gosh, I can't think of how anyone else would land in your same position. But if anyone heard this and wanted to try to take this path, what would your advice be to them if they're like, Megan Elliott, I want to be her? How do they start that journey?
Well, it's such an interesting question, Katie, because I also feel like, I came into my profession at a totally different time in where we are in the building industry. And I worry a little bit. I have a daughter right now who's in college and she's studying structural engineering. And she's on potentially on a very similar path to me. And I think about how totally different her experience is going to be and how different design is today. Both, I mean, when I went to architecture school, we drew by hand, right? And they just don't do that anymore. And so I'm watching her and her experience learning and her experience even in engineering, where she doesn't have any physical textbooks, right? Like I had notes, I still have my textbooks. I still have the tabs. I still have my notes. I can't part with these textbooks that are so much part of me. And I don't know how to translate my very Gen X experience to this new Gen Z. I don't know how much of it is transferable. I think the only thing that I could say is I have, to your point about the oxpecker, I have continued to learn the entirety of my career and continue to, I'm going to say, assemble knowledge where needed to solve a problem. And if you're open to continuing to pick up knowledge, and not just pick up the knowledge, but learn how to deploy it to solve a problem, I think that is one difference between maybe me and other career paths but starting in structural engineering and then just continuing to kind of take that platform and add more skills on top. So pick your basic platform, I'd say, whether it's engineering or architecture or real estate finance or whatever, but recognize that you're going to have to add and layer more skills on top of that. And you're never done. You're never done adding those skills because the problems keep changing.
So true. And my husband's an engineer. And so I've seen this in action. I've seen this, like, I encounter something. I'm like, we're going to have to call somebody. He's like, nope, I got this. And just diving in and learning what's needed and being able to comprehend at a basic level and then apply that knowledge to fix a problem. And it's just incredible how powerful that is when you're not afraid to take it on. Like there's some fearlessness there. There's some guts that go into being able to go for it and really respect that. It's awesome. And I think it's also incredible where you came from, where you started this journey in high school and seeing what it was like when history was gone, when context was gone. And there's that song, you don't know what you've got until it's gone. And that rings so true, not to be trite with it, but that just rings true with kind of like a foundation that kind of just drove you forward. And it's a really fun path. And I'm so glad you landed in Minnesota because it's been fun to see how that has come true in so many different projects here. And it's been a lot of fun to see how New History has grown and now in Milwaukee and what's going to be happening next for that and for Jill Pine. So just really fun stuff. Megan, is there anything else you'd like to share or leave us with?
Well, I'm going to go do my reading about an oxpecker. But
don't believe the literature about them being bloodsuckers. I'll just say that.
Okay,
because there's, no, there's some bad rap a little bit out there, and I don't want that to disfavor what they really are solving a lot of problems. So,
okay. I will keep that in mind. But thank you so much for your time, Katie, and your insightful questions.
Thank you.
Megan Elliott is a powerful collaborator. It fuels her entrepreneurial efforts and gives her ideas that break the boundaries of professional norms. The Oxpecker is the perfect symbol for her approach to business, leadership, and impact. Oxpeckers are small but mighty. They live among the giants, buffaloes, rhinos, giraffes of Africa. And while they may seem secondary, their presence is essential. They quietly remove the irritations, the ticks, and the pests that can harm their much larger companions. In doing so, they create a mutually beneficial relationship, one built on trust, attentiveness, and shared health standards. That's exactly what Megan does through her work at New History. Her clients are often the big players, developers, cities, institutions with large, complex projects. But Megan's strength lies in how she integrates herself into their process, not as an outsider delivering one-time services, but as a trusted expert who joins their team and keeps their ecosystem healthy. In these long-term projects, a strong relationship is necessary to get through all the reviews, rounds of grant applications, series of fundings, and designing within the historic guidelines. A trusted expert will pick off these project pests one by one, solving the hidden problems before they cause pain to the client. She anticipates what's coming next, and like an oxpecker, she thrives by helping others thrive. The first thing we can learn from Megan is depth over breadth. She doesn't chase 100 clients. She cultivates a few long-term relationships and goes deep. That's an oxpecker's wisdom. You don't need a whole herd to sustain you. You just need the right pairing. For solopreneurs, this means focusing on quality over quantity, serving fewer clients, but serving them better than anyone else can. Our second takeaway is about listening for the problems you can solve. Megan reminds us that great consulting isn't about selling more. It's about listening more. The oxpecker doesn't ask what it can add. It senses what is needed and it responds proactively. When you deeply understand your client's pain points, new opportunities naturally arise. Expanded scopes, ongoing support, adjacent services. This approach transforms one-time projects into enduring partnerships. And finally, we learn about mutual benefit and trust. The oxpecker isn't a parasite, it's a partner. Megan's success stems from building trust so deep that clients see her not as a vendor, but as part of their team. That's the heart of sustainable solo practice. When your work becomes integrated with your client's success, both of you are elevated. Megan's story challenges every solopreneur to think differently about their role. You don't have to be the biggest bird in the savannah to make an impact. Sometimes the greatest influence comes from those who stay close, observe carefully, and quietly solve the problems no one else sees. So in our own practice, we can think about the clients that we love to serve and perhaps think about how to serve them more. Remembering the oxpecker, being persistent and perceptive and perfectly attuned to our client's ecosystem. Success doesn't always mean flying far or fast. It can also mean perching close to those we can help the best, doing the work that keeps an entire ecosystem alive and well. Season 2 of the Flying Solo Podcast is sponsored by the Minnesota Architectural Foundation, whose mission is to invest in excellence, leadership, discovery, and equity within the profession of architecture. To join the Flying Solo movement, visit the website flyingsolo.live. That's flyingsolo.live for links to our Instagram, Substack, and the Wingbeat newsletter, a weekly dose of birdspiration and practical tips to help you grow your business and your confidence as a solopreneur architect. While you're there, take the bird quiz to discover which bird best matches your solopreneur style. For even more resources and encouragement, you can find all the Flying Solo episodes on the Gable Media platform at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com, the premier destination for podcasts about architecture and design. And if you're looking for community, connection, and real conversations, check out the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. There's a link in the show notes. Whether you join one of their masterclasses or the free Facebook group, you'll find a community of small firm architects sharing ideas, challenges, and wins, proving that while we may work solo, we're never alone. As Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, says, it's all about doing better practice and better work every day. Thank you for listening to Flying Solo. I'm Katie Kangas, and my hope is to empower you, aspiring architects and creative entrepreneurs, to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.